Remember that New Year's resolution? Yeah, you know, the one about losing all that weight. Well, forget about it, because ladies and gentlemen, we are hooked on food. But wait, how is it possible to be hooked on food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1266th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Punta Arenas who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, the best way to build a business is to offer a product that people will come back for time after time after time. The perfect example of that product is the fast food we are all love to eat. Yes, even those of us who don't admit to admitting liking fast food love it. Why? Because it's loaded with the salt, sugar, and fat our bodies crave. And so the business-minded among us have built a huge industry selling us salt, sugar, and fat. In fact, they are selling us, citizens of the world, $600 billion a year worth of salt, sugar, and fat. And that's a lot to eat. But we eat it. And if you spend a few minutes looking at the people walking down the street in any town anywhere, you'll see how successful they have become at getting us hooked on their food. We wonder about this inability of ours to manage eating. Have we become hopelessly hooked on food? How is it possible to be hooked on food? After all, we have to eat it to live. Well, who better to ask than Michael Moss, who is the author of Hooked, Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. Michael Moss, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me.
So pleased. Hot off the press. Oh my goodness. Monday release date and it's Saturday. And are you having a big celebration here?
You know, I'm enjoying lots of interviews because amazingly in this time we're in, there's a fair amount of buzz for the book. So it's really exciting as an author to get a talk to, especially to you, Michael.
Why is it that we're so fascinated with food these days as opposed to like the 1960s?
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about it, just recently, I had great hope for the pandemic in terms of, you know, it may be helping us change our eating habits because at least we got away from like work environments with the vending machine would sort of rule at 3 p.m. and produce those cravings. But you know, tragically enough, sort of, you know, the food companies were really smart in terms of shifting their marketing strategy to go after those underlying instincts of ours and those emotions that cause us to eat. And so they've actually been rejoicing at the pandemic because sales of junk, cookies and crackers and stuff we hadn't eaten since we were kids, we were buying in the grocery store and bringing home and finding and basically turning our cabinets into vending machines.
And it's amazing too, if you look at the sales for, you know, Kraft Heinz and Nabisco and PepsiCo PepsiCo is a very interesting subject because it's a bifurcated company. It sells soft drinks on one side and salty snacks on the other. And whereas the soft drink sales have been going down, the salty snacks have been going through the roof. And I guess that's kind of points out to what you're saying. We're bringing this stuff home and putting it in our kitchen cabinets and eating it away.
Yeah. And, you know, and to go back to your question about sort of what happened in the 60s, I mean, one of the fascinating things, or it's compelling things, I should say, about sort of the research that I found in researching and writing this book was that, you know, look, fundamentally, you know, as human beings, we're hooked on food. Of course we're hooked on food. If we weren't, we wouldn't be interested in eating and we'd starve to death. But what's really sort of so compelling is that, or the problem, is that the nature of our food has been changed by the food companies in the last 60 years. So So when we talk about kind of our biology and all the things that draw us to food, for millennia, I mean, this is a very good thing. It's only in the last 50 years that the nature of the food has been changed in a way that's become really problematic for us.
And that really leads us to your previous book, right? Salt, yeah. Sugar, and Fat. So yeah. I think it seems to me like your first book, for which you won the Pulitzer Prize, is a perfect setup for your hook, your hooked book. So take us back to salt, sugar, and fat, and tell us how those three ingredients became the foundation for the fast food and the processed food industry.
Right, and I'll just take you back one tiny step before that, because the Pulitzer was actually for my reporting on pathogens in food, like E. coli and Salmonella, where the food industry was losing control over its ingredients. And salt, sugar, and fat came about because one of my sources who tested E. coli for the meat industry said to me, look, Michael, as tragic as these incidents of contamination are, you really should look at the things this industry intentionally adds to its products. He was really concerned about all the salt that goes into meat, which got me looking at sugar and fat as sort of this unholy trinity of ingredients that the food companies use to get us to, you know, not just like their products, but want more and more. And so that was the basis of Salt, Sugar, Fat, where I was able to crawl inside the industry and get their documents and their people talking to me about how they did it. It's kind of a detective story. But when the book came out, the very first question I got from an interviewer was, hey, Michael, you know, you end the book on this hopeful note saying, you know, knowing all the tricks that the companies get up to lure us into their products is oddly empowering. And ultimately, you know, we are the ones making decisions on what to buy and how much to eat. He says, how can you say that? I mean, isn't this stuff you're writing about as addictive as drugs? And, you know, I was taken aback. I mean, I'm going like, you mean Twinkies or like crack cocaine? I mean, no way. I mean, I was totally resistant to the idea. But then something else happened just in the last couple of years. All of the big food companies, in responding to our concerns about their products, have been cutting back on salt, sugar, fat. And if anything, our trouble with food is on the rise. And not just obesity and type 2 diabetes, but just the amount of effort we have to put into sort of controlling our diet or losing control of it in other ways, or just the feeling of, like, you know, a lost love for eating meals with friends in the way we did before we fell so hard for convenience food. So I wanted to look more closely at what the food companies do. And it turns out some of the biggest weapons they have to get us hooked on their products are not on the label. They're not in the nutrition facts box. They're the company's ability to tap our basic instincts to get us to crave their products.
When did the apple fall on your head to bring you to the realization that addiction could be part of the formula here?
Yeah, there was this moment I was talking to a terrific scientist named Dana Small. She was trained up at McGill and she's now at Yale. She was the very first person to figure out how to look at how the brain responds to food when you're actually eating food, because normally you can't do a brain scan of someone eating because the chewing motion will blur the images. But Dana, being a self-professed chocoholic, realized she could put a square of chocolate on her subjects' tongues and have them lie still in the scanner, and as the chocolate melts, the images, the brain will respond. And what she did, though, she didn't just sort of see the wow parts of the brain, the reward centers lighting up as her subjects lay in the scanner with the chocolate melting in their mouth. She fed them so much chocolate until they got to the point where they just refused anymore, saying they would get sick if they had another square of chocolate. And then she could see the other part of the brain, which I like to call the break or the stop part of the brain, the thinking part of the brain that says, hey, Michael, I really think you've had enough chocolate. You really should knock it off. See that light up. And for me, you know, that was the moment of awakening when I realized that addiction is something is not just related to the substance we're imbibing in, whether it's cigarettes, alcohol, drugs, or food. It's in the brain. And we do have this ability to control it. And that ability, you know, disappears due to various vulnerabilities that we have. That was really my moment.
Well, there you go. Okay, and it was an apple that fell on your head, and you went, ouch, what is this? Look at this.
Well, and it was troubling to me, too, because, you know, look, I mean, as an investigative reporter, I've spent 10 years, you know, holding the food giants sort of accountable for their products. But I had to step back and sort of ask that question, well, how much of this is on us? And how much of this is explained by our evolutionary biology, not as a way of sort of blaming us, but as a way of seeing how we might have become unwitting co-conspirators with the food industry, and as an explanation for why we fall so hard for their products.
And, you know, the whole notion of addiction was brought up some time ago in a lawsuit against McDonald's, correct? You kind of paint this picture in the prologue of your book with respect to a young gal who has an affair with McDonald's.
Yeah, her name is Jasmine Bradley, and people may remember her because when she sued McDonald's back in 2000 for making her significantly overweight, kind of the world laughed and basically said, wait a minute, where's the personal responsibility in this? You know, you had to know what you were eating, you know, on a regular basis was not good for you. But, you know, her attorney consulting with attorneys who went after Big Tobacco introduced kind of this claim of addiction. And the judge was really intrigued. Look, ultimately the case didn't go anywhere, but the judge was sort of saying, oh, wait a minute. If this food is indeed addictive in some way, that could totally undercut, you know, Jasmine's ability to express or have free will in her purchase and eating decisions. So he was really curious about that. And of course, that made me even more curious about what is it about this food and how might we think about it? And if there's any parallels to drugs and alcohol and cigarettes, what can we learn about our addictions to those substances that might teach us something about food?
And one of the comments Jasmine made with respect to McDonald's and her affair with it, her addiction, she was compelled to go to McDonald's for food. And it wasn't just for the food, for the satisfaction she had in eating the food, but she was compelled to go there also because it felt good. It was something other than food there that attracted her. And you brought this up earlier in our conversation about our feelings and how we relate to food and what food means with respect to our place in the world, just having a meal with somebody.
Yeah, I mean, we often, if not mostly, don't eat because we're truly kind of biologically hungry. We eat for other reasons, for emotional reasons or for habit, because it's dinner time. But true hunger pains, fortunately, are a rare thing in this country and lots of other parts of the world. But and so Jasmine had that experience of becoming kind of so habituated to eating at McDonald's and other fast food chains that it filled an emotional need in her. She was, for instance, the second of 10 kids in her family. Didn't feel she got, you know, the attention she needed from her parents or life in general, and eating became kind of that thing that gave her warmth and comfort when other things didn't.
Yeah, she could go to McDonald's and feel at home.
Well, and she could kind of see it. She could kind of see it in other people sitting at McDonald's. She was very perceptive about that. I mean, her sense is that, you know, a lot of people dining there frequently are lonely, and that experience gives them some sense of friendship and comfort.
Now, the attorney originally decided to go after McDonald's because, for one reason, but another attorney said, and he had a subject who was a middle-aged man who was grossly overweight. But everybody said, yeah, you got to take responsibility, man. You're a grown-up. Why can't you just get a hold of your diet here? And so the other attorney says, you know, you needed a more sympathetic subject to work with. And then refiled that lawsuit and brought up the whole notion of addiction. And that's
really... for a really important reason, because not all of us remember, but for decades, the tobacco industry denied that smoking was addictive vehemently. I mean, the heads of the biggest tobacco companies, you know, went to a hearing in Congress, I think it was 1996, and just one after the other denied. Well, you know, in 2000, the biggest tobacco manufacturer of all, Philip Morris, completely flipped, publicly conceded that not only smoking was bad for your health, but it was, in fact, no ifs, ands, or buts, addictive. And that was such an important moment to me, too, in thinking about the parallels between other addictive substances and food, because shortly after that, the CEO of Philip Morris was asked in some legal proceedings to define addiction. And he said, to me, addiction is a repetitive behavior that some people find difficult to quit. And I thought that was such a perfect definition.
It's also a perfect place to break for a quick break, and we will be right back. This is Michael Olson, Food Chain Radio. Michael Moss, author of Hooked, Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giant Exploit Our Addiction. Right back.
let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it seems like the definition of addiction is a repetitive behavior that some people find difficult to quit, would perfectly fit for Jaslyn, who could not quit eating McDonald's foods. And so she and an attorney took McDonald's to court for making her fat, but they didn't win that particular lawsuit. But in a way, that suit really had a way of focusing attention on our eating, did it not?
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. Scientists began studying food. Look, people who used to study drug addiction shifted over to study food addiction because of the huge sort of health implications of overeating or bad eating habits. And I think people generally just became more curious about, hey, wait a minute, maybe there is something there that compels us toward these foods. And I should mention, too, that when Philip Morris changed its mind on cigarettes, at the time, it was the single largest manufacturer of processed food in North America. And so that definition of addiction, a repetitive behavior that some people find difficult to quit, actually fit really perfectly its own food products.
Trinkies.
And what you said, there you go. And one of the key words in that definition is some, because not everybody falls for their products. Not everybody loses control. And by the way, I should mention the chief lawyer, the general counsel of Philip Morris, told me how he could smoke one cigarette a day at business meetings and the company just put his pack away and not touch it until the next day. He couldn't go near a bag of Oreo cookies, which the company also made at the time, for fear that he would eat the entire bag. He would lose control. So, I mean, that's one of the surprising things about me, is that a lot of the insiders I met in this industry don't eat their own product for fear of losing control.
Now, the same observation could be made of almost any drug, could it not? There are people who take heroin all their lives and don't have any terrible ill effects. I mean, they can be functional citizens and have jobs and raise families and whatnot. Others, not so much.
Right. Alcohol, cigarettes, the same. There are casual users of heroin. There are casual users of beer and wine, casual users of cigarettes. What seems to be an issue here is, you know, our individual vulnerability to those substances. And that can change over time. It can change over our lives. We could be vulnerable at one point in our lives, not another time. Or at times of the day. I mean, I think we've all felt that 3 p.m., you know, craving for a sugary cookie, right? That just kind of comes on. I mean, that's a point of vulnerability in the day, where in the morning you're not feeling stressed out and you're in control of your habits. So that's, you know, addiction happens on a spectrum that changes through time and changes from person to person.
Kind of like autism in a way.
Yeah, and
a spectrum disorder.
And our trouble with food is on that spectrum too. I mean, at one end, it's uncontrollable binging. And on the other end, it's just like, you know, this nagging feeling that's kind of something that's not quite right with what we're eating and how we approach food.
Well, you know, that the fight against Philip Morris and the tobacco industry was really quite spectacular when it happened. And you made mention of the fact that the tobacco companies made a strategic decision to flip, to say, okay, it is addictive. But
yeah, and that's why the addiction thing was also really powerful for people looking at food, attorneys looking at food potentially too, representing Jaslyn and other people who've sort of succumbed to the allures of fast food and fast groceries. Because once the industry conceded addiction in terms of smoking, jurors started awarding for plaintiffs who got ill from smoking. And jurors could then understand. It sort of, it got over that personal responsibility hurdle, which is now, wait a minute, you know, before you might have said, come on, smokers knew what they were doing. In fact, that's what juries said. But in the context of addiction and free will and our ability to make decisions, that becomes a much more problematic thing for the industries.
And thus was born the term addictive personality.
Well, that's certainly one aspect of it, yeah.
So you make mention of a fascinating experiment that took place on the U.S. narcotic farm with respect to narcotics in people.
Yeah, I got to know one of the psychologists who went to work at the very first facility, federal facility established in the United States to help heroin users. And it was out in near Lexington, Kentucky, and it was so eye-opening for this psychologist, because he went in there, you know, A, thinking that, you know, heroin users were despicable people with no redeeming value, and he came away just charmed and amazed at the talent and skills of people who were in the facility as patients and had just gotten hooked on heroin. But the other thing that really caught him was this notion that many of them could use heroin casually, take it or leave it. And that surprised him, because he, like I did much later, you know, came to think that, you know, if you began using heroin, you're almost certainly to end up in the gutter as a junkie eventually. And it's kind of just not the case. It really depends on the person and their circumstances.
And you made mention of an interesting 18-year-old girl who said, when asked why she took up heroin, she said, well, when you're 18 and where I live, that's what you do. So get over it. Who's going to stop that?
You know, yeah, in her environment, in her neighborhood, is what she was saying, which was, you know, low economic, socioeconomic. It's kind of, you know, the temptation, it's just right there in your face. And there was kind of very little reason not to do that. And that's one of the ways that food is actually can be more addictive than drugs and alcohol and cigarettes. It's everywhere, and the marketing is everywhere, and it's cheap, and it's accessible, and it's legal. And so the repercussions of overeating are few and far between, at least as we perceive them.
There you go.
It's kind of what you do in the United States, which is overeat.
Because it's here, it's ubiquitous.
Yes.
Every street corner almost in the city has food and soft drinks.
Yeah,
and it all tends to be loaded up with sugar and salt and fat.
Right, which is really important when you look at the chemistry of addiction too, because it's quite true that, you know, a Twinkie or Oreos won't light up the brain's reward center like cocaine or heroin will do. But as Nora Volkow pointed out, she's the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, a longtime drug researcher who's also looked at food addiction. As she pointed out to me, food doesn't have to excite the brain as much as drugs because of that environment, because it's so accessible. It takes very little to get us to act impulsively and eat things we will later wish we didn't.
Yeah, pick up that bag of Oreos and go out to the car, and nobody's going to think poorly of you unless they watch you eat the whole bag.
Yeah, and not just Oreos. I mean, I should point out that something like 75% of what we eat is now sort of falling in the category of highly processed food. It's that, you know, 90% of the center store where products don't even, you can't even tell what the original food stuff is that went into those products. They've been so highly manipulated and engineered and turned into something else. So it's not just the sweets and the desserts and the snacks, although snacking is huge, It's a lot of the stuff in the grocery store that passes for, you know, high quality, good for you food that in fact is problematic.
Well, and yeah, I guess, and that's why 40% of America is obese or somewhere mm-hmm. in that neighborhood. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, I think we're up to 42% now, and another third on top of that are overweight to some extent. And look, it's a crude measure of health. There are people who can have a high body mass index and be incredibly strong and fit. So I hesitate to even use it, but I think it is indicative of a lost control too, the extent to which somebody doesn't want to weigh that much and yet finds it really difficult to lose that weight is part of the problem that we're talking about here.
Well, you talk about Nora Valkow was at the National Institute of Drug Abuse and her earlier work with respect to food addictions. And one of the things that I think she made mention of, or maybe you made mention of it, was the notion of that speed matters.
Yeah, she was one of the first researchers to note that the faster a drug hit the brain, the more apt we were to act compulsively on that signal, want, crave, and obtain that drug. So it turns out, so speed has become a hallmark of addiction. The faster that cigarettes or alcohol or drugs get into your system, into the brain, the bigger the reaction is. And so one of the fascinating things about food, and one of the things that makes it even more perilous for us in terms of control, is that there's nothing faster than food in the way that it hits the brain. And people have done this amazing experiment where they tested people for how fast sugar is perceived by the brain. They sat them down, put a little dab of sugar on their tongue, and they were asked to push a button when they sensed sweet taste in their brain. And so the signal from the sugar went to their taste buds, to the brain, back to their finger, and they were pushing that button at a little, not much more than a half a second.
Wow.
Right? So that's how fast the sugar is hitting the brain. Smoking will hit the brain in a few seconds. Likewise, alcohol, some drugs can take sort of several minutes. So in some ways, because food uses the system, our own signaling system, entice us into eating, it kind of cheats. And so the sugar doesn't go directly into the brain. It's triggering the taste buds and the taste signals that go to the brain. So in that way, it's much faster than drugs than hitting the brain.
Mm-hmm. What about salt?
Salt, same thing, same sensation. I think they did test the speed with salt, and it was a slightly slower, perhaps, or roughly in that same time frame as well, because again, salt is hitting those taste buds and using the same conduits to the brain.
Mm-hmm. And then fat, you made mention of a study of what really turned people on with respect to food, and cheeseburger showed up right away, and then bacon and egg sandwich, and then pizza. So fat has to be a really big ingredient in the mix then.
Yeah, cheese is huge. I mean, the industry calls fat the mouthfeel ingredient because it's that, you know, it's that sensation of biting into a toasted cheese sandwich. That sends a signal to the brain, probably mostly through what's called the trigeminal nerve, as opposed to part of a taste bud, but still very quickly wows the reward center of the brain and compels us to say, yeah, I'll have some of that.
Do you remember that fake fat called Olestra?
I do.
That didn't quite have the mouthfeel of real fat?
No, it didn't. And so look, I mean, every time we compel the industry to sort of, you know, straighten up its products a little bit, make them healthier, you know, they'll try some new things, but the bottom line is sales. And if they can't sell as much of the new thing, they'll go back to the old and just assume they will follow along.
Well, before we go into how all of this is having an impact on how our food is made and processed for us, I'd like to ask, looking back at the suit against lawsuit, the suit against Philip Morris, our fighting back does seem to have made a difference, does it not? At least we have menus now in McDonald's listing how many calories that are there.
Yeah, and to some extent, Jaslyn sort of had that good effect of you know, causing regulators to sit up and say, hey, wait a minute, maybe people do need more information here to help them make that decision.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host this hour for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we have Michael Moss with us, author of Hooked. Nah, gotta admit it. We're all hooked on food, but how is it possible to be hooked on food? Because we need to eat it every day. That's where we'll go when we get back. Do stay tuned.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, April 1943.
It had been months since any of us had seen a woman. One night when we were steaming through some real thick fog, we raised an unidentified ship on the radar and went to investigate. Now, when I say a foggy night, I mean the fog was so thick we could not see the water under the ship. We pulled up real close to this mystery ship and challenged with a signal light. It turned out to be a Russian fishing boat. We signaled, "What's your name?" The answer came back, "Olga." We asked, "How many women aboard?" Olga answered, "Five." Word spread quickly throughout the Dale that women were out there, and soon the rails were manned with sailors hooting and hollering into the fog.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain, and we're talking today about how we have become hooked on food. But not only how we have become hooked on food, but really, the big question to me is, how are we being hooked on food by those who make our food? And here's a man who went into the factories and learned the lessons. And a first question that pops into my mind is, how did you get people to talk to you about how they did this?
Well, you know, as an investigative reporter, the first thing I look for are documents. And I was incredibly lucky to come across this trove of documents from inside the industry as they were formulating and marketing their products and talking about them. And those documents enabled me to identify people in the industry who would talk to me. And surprisingly, many of them have come to have misgivings about their life work. I mean, they can kind of defend themselves by saying, look, we invented these convenience foods in a more innocent era when people were using them as an occasional treat and not every day or several times a day. And so they can kind of excuse themselves that way. But I was really struck by how they themselves see the food system and these food companies, their control over us, as being out of control.
So you actually got to into some meeting notes where you saw people actually making comments back and forth on how to deal with these questions about how to present our food. You got the names and called them up and they'd actually talk to you.
Yeah, and just to give you an example from the latest book, Hooked, I mean, one of the things that we evolved to like in food and to be drawn to is variety. You know, as humans populated the earth, we became really good at adapting to whatever food and whatever diet was available in the hand. And so we, by nature, get really excited by what's called the smorgasbord effect. You walk into a Chinese buffet, your plate's full. You might be full, but you look down the table and see something new, you're going to put it on your plate and eat it or be more apt to. And so the industry knows that if it targets variety, if it presents itself as being variable to us, well, it will get excited to know that. And so there are studies that grocers did with the food manufacturers, identifying customers by how excited they would get about variety. And that's why when you walk into the cereal aisle, for example, it's all sugary starch, basically, right? But
sugar there on
200,
sugar.
There could be 200 different brand versions of that sugary starch for you, and sort of this kind of fake appearance of variety. And throughout the grocery store, you see that.
I wonder what percentage of the grocery's sales are those in those boxes of sugary sugar. It must be huge because there's a big selection in every store. People must buy them. You know,
more broadly, it's about the latest study that I saw, and this was sort of shocking, is that about 75% of what we eat falls into that category of sort of highly processed food. Not a little bit sugary, but it's
everything.
The stuff we probably, yes, exactly.
Goodness sakes. Well, you made a mention of a couple very interesting elements in this whole question of addiction. And the first one that comes to mind is it the stomach or the brain? And you talked about an interesting surgery that took place, I don't know, must have been way back when, in the 60s or 70s or something, about gastric bypass surgeries where they lop off a chunk of your stomach.
Yes, and that's become a quite popular procedure, sort of a last gasp procedure that people take when nothing else they try works in terms of helping them to lose weight when they're clinically obese. And the thing is, the surgery works because what happens is they shrink the stomach down to an incredibly small size. And the unfortunate part is that you'll no longer get to sit down and have the kind of meal that you had before. You have to take your food in very small, careful portions. But one of the things that the surgeons have discovered in following people over time is that you might lose as much as 30% of your weight, although that could still leave you classified as obese. But then you kind of plateau out. And some people even start developing cravings again for food, binge-type cravings, even after having the surgery. And the reason for that is that, not only does our stomach sort of guide our eating habits, but so much of that is happening in the brain.
And if it's happening in your brain, then that would mean it's not the stomach that leads to the addiction.
Yeah, or else it's a teamwork. It's possibly that as well. But the brain is just so fascinating because the other thing that really stopped me when people say, oh, wait, food is addictive as drugs, is that, but wait a minute. I mean, drugs and cigarettes and alcohol have these really harsh chemical ingredients that you don't actually find in food. Well, it turns out that our brains produce these chemicals naturally that are associated with addiction, dopamine being one of them, and there are others. And so what happens is that the substance, whether it's smoking or alcohol or food, is sort of creating this flood of these natural chemicals in our brain, which cause us to desire and like something and want more and more of it.
And these are probably the instincts or the chemical reactions that were formulated way back when we're living in not so civilized circumstances wherein there wasn't food on every corner.
Absolutely. And it's not just the gut and the brain. I was startled to learn how important body fat is to our ability to sort of control our eating habits. And again, it's really important to point out that for most of our existence as humans, having a fair amount of body fat was an incredibly good thing. It enabled our brains to grow. It enabled us to get through hard times. It enabled us to have more babies. It was only recently that body fat has become an issue as we get lured in sort of uncontrollably to overeating. But The thing about body fat is it's a living, thinking organ that communicates with the gut and the brain, and its sole purpose in life appears to be resisting any effort on your part to shrink it, diminish it in any way. So if you go on a low-calorie diet, one of the things that's going to trip you up is your body fat, which is going to be sending signals to the brain, making you hungrier than you otherwise were. And it'll send signals to the brain, slowing down your metabolism as a self-preservation scheme. I was totally struck by the diabolicalness of body fat, if you will.
That's very interesting, because that's the principle of the keto diet, is that you burn fats instead of carbohydrates, which essentially means that you're on a high fat diet, and then your body learns to burn fats, and so that's a way of reducing some of your body fat. But who knows? Now, please tell us about the strange case of Phineas Cage.
So he was a railroad worker who got injured on the job when, you know, this huge metal spike pierced his brain. It was like sitting on the ground with a spike coming out of it. And he managed to live, but he had an incredible personality change where he was less able to kind of control his emotions and actions and desires. And he's one of the people who helped scientists who studied the brain understand how different parts of the brain serve different functions. And I love how they divide the brain into two categories. One is the go brain, which is where all of our pulses live, our instincts to eat and to flee from danger. And then there's the stop part of the brain, or the thinking part of the brain, the rational, that says, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should put the brake on this. I think we've done enough of that. Or maybe that's not really a good thing to do. And I really like that aspect of thinking about the brain, because you know, those stop and go impulses can run throughout the brain, through different parts of the brain as well. But it's so important in terms of addiction, because our vulnerability to addiction ultimately comes down to kind of that balance between the go impulse and the stop rational in our brain, and the external and internal influences that change that balance of power over time.
So a go and a no brain.
You know, and it goes back to the speed. If you're eating a really fast food, a food that's hitting your brain really fast, you're going to be acting on that impulse so quickly that the stop part of your brain can't even catch up. You're running down the road to the store to eat whatever.
Yeah, this poor Jocelyn was heading for the store, for the McDonald's, because she knew the pleasure was going to be there right away. So you've looked into this incredible knowledge that we've accumulated about our addictive behavior, and I'm certain those who manufacture our foods have been doing the same. How do you see the interaction between that knowledge and what our food processing industry has done to our food?
I mean, so you can see how, and kind of all the things we've talked about, the industry have done things to exploit those deep primitive instincts of ours. So we love food that's cheap. So they use chemistry labs to come up with formulations of chemical additives to food, not as a way of just mimicking the real thing, but to drive down the cost of their product. Because if they can sell a Pop-Tart for 10 cents less, they know that's instinctually going to get us excited and attract us to the food. We talked about speed, and one of the creations of the processed food industry was snacking. Snacking has become the fourth American meal. We're getting something like 550 calories on average per person per day from snack food, much of it being highly processed and not all that good for you. And the other thing that they did too is recognize that we are drawn to calories as much as we are to, say, salt, sugar, and fat. You know, we have sensors in our gut, but also possibly in our mouth, that detect how many calories there are in food. And we love calories because, remember, for most of our existence, getting calories was a matter of life and death. And so the industry has been incredibly good at creating foods that pack in the calories as tightly and densely as they can, which, you know, which wows our brain even before we open up the package. I was looking at a package of Fritos the other day for something else and looked on the label. There are 1,440 calories in this one little bag, which a lot of us would be tempted to eat the whole thing in one sitting. And it's that caloric density that I think is the hallmark of processed food and the thing that trips so many of us up.
And that's where, of course, you get the extra heat energy that has nowhere to go in your body, so it's stored as fat, and away you go.
Yeah, and also kind of the bigger point with that, too, is that we're designed not just to eat, but to overeat, which was a terrific thing to do up until the last 50 years. And what the industry has done overall is made overeating an everyday thing.
Do we have any defenses? I mean, as consumers, as an eater? What can we do?
Yeah, I think there are defenses that we can draw upon from kind of the world of drug abuse and other substance addictions and that being this. I mean, I still believe as a journalist that knowledge is power. You know, knowing what the food companies are up to in terms of creating their products and marketing to marketing them to us is oddly empowering. I mean, I can walk in the store now and kind of laugh at all the advertising tricks that the companies use to get us to pull their product off the shelves and put it in our cart. But with addiction, what we've learned from drugs is that sort of the compulsion to overeat can come on so fast that you not only need knowledge, but you need a plan. And you need to be executing that plan, you know, before the craving hits you. And so, you know, I'm using the 3 p.m. cookie as an example. But if that's your issue, you know, probably at 2:55, whether your plan is to get up and stretch or call a friend or substitute in another food that you have more control over, like a handful of nuts, you probably need to be doing that, you know, 5 minutes before that craving hits you in order to fuel up the stop part of your brain and change that balance between stop and go. I think that's the one lesson I've learned from looking at addiction more broadly and how we can truly kind of regain control of our eating habits.
Got to compete against ourselves. It's the only way to win. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Michael Moss, author of Hooked on Fat. Warning, fair warning, if you get the book, you'll end up reading the whole thing. And there's a lot of calories in there, so beware. So remember, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.